My name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. It's not just my opinion that I'm an alcoholic. There are others who agree. I was hospitalized for this little drinking problem, and because the insurance companies would not insure alcoholics, right? Pay for alcoholics because we're so unstable. They didn't want to write alcoholism on the medical form. So instead they listed, he is suffering from a chronic, non-organic brain syndrome. Which is alcoholism, you know, it's chronic. Welcome here. We're in Vancouver, Washington, for those of you who are new to town. I got in this afternoon and it started snowing, and snow for me is kind of fun. I don't live in it, but I like to visit it, and it occurred to me that anybody who would come out on a snowy, awful January night to an AA meeting in a cold Episcopal church is probably a pretty desperate person. So I like being with desperate people. Welcome. Some of you might be new to AA. Every January we get a whole new bunch of folks come in. Kind of didn't quite make it through New Year's, so as the weeks of January go on, more and more people start showing up, and AA is a funny program. Even in our own literature, we say we are not an organization in the ordinary sense of the term. Our rules are different, the way we do things is different. In many ways, we're unique. The book on one page says that we are people who would not ordinarily associate. And that's real true. Most of us don't have that much in common. Our politics doesn't bring us together. Our religious attachments or non-attachments don't bring us together. A lot of our interests don't bring us together, but we have a primary focus, and anybody who was drowning in a sea of alcohol, we're glad to see. And that's the only question we ask. Are you drowning in a sea of alcohol? Come on in. Nice to see you. We don't care who you vote for or whether you vote at all. We don't care if you sleep with anybody or no one at all. We don't care how you spend your off time. If you're drowned and in booze, we're glad to see you. Now, this is always a bit of a problem in the history of AA because as more and more people have shown up, it makes some of us who've been here for a while nervous. AA gets started in the 1930s, and all of the very, very early AAs in Akron, Ohio, were white male Protestants. Then Irish Catholics started showing up from Cleveland, and it stretched the group, you know. And then women started showing up, which really stretched the group. Some of the early AA males said, well, we don't want women to join the program because everybody knows what women are who drink. And they suddenly got very nervous about their reputations. Mm-hmm. When the first gay man showed up at an AA meeting in Akron, Ohio in 1935, they thought they would all drop dead. And they had to ask, can we let this guy in or not? And they had to have a group conscience. And they were still very Christian in orientation, very Oxford groupy in a lot of ways. And the one question that ended the conversation was, what would the master do? Come on in. Made them all nervous, but he got to join the group. AA is a funny organization. You remember when you say you are? And the people they ask to speak at AA meetings are not necessarily the people who are most well-wrapped. You need to know this. See, in other organizations, they want people who are role models. Not in AA. In AA, we ask people to speak who will serve as warnings for others. So that at the end of my talking with you tonight, you'll all go home feeling much better about your program and your sponsor and your home group meeting, you know. I might have problems, but at least I'm not as crazy as he is. It happens a lot. My sponsor is a recovering alcoholic of the worst type, who goes to meetings because he has to. If he doesn't go to meetings a lot, he would be chained to a bed howling at the moon in some institution within 48 hours. We're all convinced of it. I've learned a lot from him because he is completely convinced about his own alcoholism and how every day sober is a gift, and if you aren't appreciative for the gift, you could lose it. And he's got about 26, 27 years, and he still needs every one of the steps regularly. I go to meetings with him sometimes, and you probably don't do this in Vancouver, but I have been noted to judge others during meetings. I'll wonder how sober they are, and do they go to meetings, and do they have a sponsor, and has this jerk ever read the book? Those questions will go on. What medications are they on? What medications should they be on? Those questions. Sometimes I want to just write a little prescription and hand it to them, you know. But Terry and I will go to meetings together, and we'll leave the meeting at the end, and he'll say, "What a good meeting. What a good meeting." And I'll say to myself, "Have we been to the same meeting? Didn't he hear all those jerks in there, all those idiots and self-obsessed bigots? Didn't he hear them?" His opinion is, if you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and identify, you're in a pretty good place. If you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and judge, you're not in a very good place. And the judgment can be, "These people are so good and I'm so bad." You're in trouble. Or, "These people are so bad and I'm so good." You're in trouble. When we identify, something good's going on. So if you identify with anything I say this evening, it means you are a very desperate person. And you will need many meetings for many years. And you are nowhere close to getting well, I assure you. People who get well bore me pretty quickly anyway, so. I'm a native Californian. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, down in San Jose. My father was born in San Francisco 2 years before the quake of 06. And we have alcoholism all over that side of the family. That's kind of the Irish Catholic Democratic side of the family, but full of drunks. His father was the chief gardener at Stanford University for years and years and years. Irish labor, you know. And he had a couple of brothers, and a couple of them ended up in Boston, and a couple of them disappeared. Well, where could they have gone? Well, Skid Row somewhere. You know, like a lot of our relatives. On the Irish Catholic Democratic side of the family, we never talked about alcoholics. Instead, we talked about people who were characters. And we would say things like, "Sean is sure becoming a character." I have a cousin named Sean. He lives in Cork. He came over with his wife and a couple of kids, and it took me about, I'd say 3 minutes to figure out the dynamics of that family. And they wanted me to run them on a tour of San Francisco, which I love doing, and kind of back of this and look at this and look at that. And I noticed, and I'm no rocket scientist, and I have all the denial in the world, and I miss the most obvious things, but even I noticed that about every 2 hours, Sean got a little jagged. And he needed a drink. And as soon as you gave him a beer, he was fine. Well, the day just smoothed out as soon as I found that missing piece. And every couple of hours, we got Sean a beer. We had a wonderful time. His wife was no longer anxious that he would go into seizures, you know, and the kids relaxed too, because Dad was relaxed. It was very interesting. On the Swedish Lutheran Republican side of the family, big Swedish farm family, that's where my mom's from, right from the old country. We didn't have alcoholics either, we had nervous people. And we had some people who were so nervous that they'd get hospitalized. And then they would dry them out, you know, and come out of the hospital, they'd be fine, they'd start drinking again, they'd get nervous again and end up back in the hospital. My mom is surrounded by alcoholics, and she doesn't see it. It doesn't occur to her. She's living in a retirement place now, and she was talking about a man that lived down the street, and she was a little worried about him because sometimes he would park the car on the lawn and then pass out on the driveway. And what did I think? And I asked, well, does he drink much? And she said, well, of course not, but he's very nervous. So in my family, alcoholism was a lot like having a rhinoceros in the living room. Everybody knew it was there. But we also knew if you said, oh, look, there's a rhinoceros in the living room, what should we do? Number one, everybody gets mad at you because we were getting along just fine before you came along. And you're the one that has to take it out. No one else is going to volunteer for the job. So we never confronted the rhinoceros. We pretended they weren't there. Or we walked around them, or we decorated around them, or we put white tablecloths over them so no one would see, you know? And in my family, the rhinoceros slept a lot. The pattern for the alcoholic males in my family, on both sides, is to be very, very involved in church and in school. And in local government, you help out on the Civil Service Commission, you get involved in this, you do stuff with the fire department, you're very involved in the local community. And then you work real hard, you come home, eat, and drink yourself unconscious every night for 50 years. That's what you do. So you never do any drunk driving, you don't get into fights in bars, you don't do anything that's wild, you just kind of miss whole decades. You know, I was different because when I drank, I wanted to jump in the car and drive around and meet everybody. When I drank, I became energized and extroverted. And that's one of the reasons why I got help fast. I'm the first male alcoholic in my family to be sober, not the last. Now, there are several of us. My oldest brother has almost 8 months of sobriety. And his oldest daughter has 4 years. There are others of us who are getting sober, but it was very, very strange there for a while. My sponsor thinks that if you're the kind of alcoholic who early, early, early in your drinking gets into big trouble fast, you're lucky. You know, if you have 3 beers and hit a cop, this is good. This is good. You will get help. Where a lot of us who are just functional alcoholics, you know, we'll just hold on. We'll keep the job, we'll keep this going, we'll kind of stay sedated and die an inch a day for 25 or 35 or 45 years. It's a much harder road to hoe. I was attending a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the East Bay, Oakland, Berkeley, where I mostly go to meetings. In the last couple of years, and there was a guy there who said, alcoholism is a lot like dancing with a gorilla. You're not done dancing until the gorilla is done dancing. This is an important concept to think about. Because early in the evening, you don't think you're in trouble. You think the gorilla's cute. And you think you're getting along real well. And you also, in the back of your mind, figure, later on tonight, I might get lucky, you're having a good time. The gorilla is holding you real close, and you know this intimacy is once in a lifetime. This is it. Later on, you want to sit down. The gorilla doesn't want to. You don't sit. Little later on, the gorilla wants to tango, and you explain you don't know how, and the gorilla doesn't care. You tango, you end up doing things you never thought you'd be doing. A lot of us are killed by the gorilla. The last 10 years, one of the big openings for me emotionally and spiritually is all of the rhythms and vibrations and flavors of loss and grief and people who overdose and suicide and drop. I mean, it's a big part of life. The gorilla kills an awful lot of people. People who love us notice that we're dancing with the gorilla. They become full of fear and danger, and they want to rescue us. And what they want to do is break into the cage and get between us and the gorilla and save our lives. And then they get their arms and legs ripped off. Which always surprises them. They can't understand how this happened. And it's why they also have a program. And it's called Al-Anon. And a lot of the Al-Anon program, well, there are several points. I mean, it's a very sophisticated and subtle program, and I've been a member for a long time. Al-Anon says, number one, stay out of the cage. Number two, let them dance. But I'm full of all these feelings. That's right. And talk to other people who have the same feelings, and we can walk through this. You're going to be angry and sad and upset and happy. We get to talk about this stuff, but jumping into the cage doesn't help anybody. It just gives another casualty, you know? Someone told me that the entire Al-Anon program is spoken by stewards and stewardesses in airplanes every time the plane takes off. The steward or the stewardess will say, in case of a sudden drop of pressure, oxygen masks will fall from the ceiling. Put your own on first. Then you can be helpful to others. But a lot of us don't want to put our oxygen masks on because we want to help the others, and then we all pass out and die together. So keep that in mind. If you're clean and sober tonight, and you're a drunk or a junkie, if you're clean and sober tonight, it's a real good sign that the gorilla has let go. If the gorilla has let go, get out of the cage. And don't go back into the cage even when the gorilla starts humming your song. Now, it doesn't hum everybody's song, but a lot of us are out of the cage and all of a sudden we want to dance again, and it just catches us completely by surprise. I hear this at meetings. Well, you hear several things at meetings if you go to a lot of meetings. Some people will say that they have not had the desire or the thought of having a drink since the day they entered Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am very glad for them. But I'm not one of those guys. I regularly think of drinking. I regularly think of robbing banks. I regularly think of taking dope all the time. And I keep waiting for me to get over it because I'm sure it's a sign of deep spiritual perversion. But it keeps going on. And it's been going on for 21 years that I've been sober. I was driving across the Bay Bridge from San Francisco and back into Oakland, and they had this large sign for a Mexican restaurant named Chevy's, and it said, "Cranberry Margaritas." It was a deep and profound experience for me. And I thought about cranberry margaritas for the next 3 weeks, regularly, every time. I just needed them very badly. Well, I wish I didn't do that, but I do that. I have drinking dreams still. I had one not long ago. Those used to just throw me completely. And it's scary. You know, what am I doing wrong? I just had a drinking dream. What step are you on? So after I had a couple of these drinking dreams, and they were very vivid, weird things, I asked my sponsor, but I didn't want to tell him that I was having them. Because then, you know, they get preachy. So I thought I'd ask him a theoretical question. I said, what does it mean if someone going to meetings has drinking dreams in another state? What does that mean? And he said, have you had the one yet? And then he told me this drinking dream that he had, and it was very twisted and perverse. And I said, absolutely not, I haven't had a dream like that. And I felt better than him immediately. And then about 6 months later, I had that dream. So I said, what's it mean? You know, does it mean I really crave it deep in my, the program hasn't gotten deep into my psyche? Is that what it means? And you can get real nuts over stuff like this. And he's full of common sense. And he said that drinking dreams mean two things. Number one, they mean that for us, our drinking has become a nightmare. Number two, people who have drinking dreams don't get drunk. He said, did you ever have a drinking dream while you were drinking? No. He said, only sober people get them. He said, when you stop smoking cigarettes, you'll have smoking dreams. When you get off caffeine, you'll have caffeine dreams. He said, it's very weird, but that's how it works. So I continue getting those. And some, when I was 10 years sober, I woke up from a very vivid drinking dream knowing that I had lost 10 years of sobriety. And it wasn't until my second cup of coffee before I realized I didn't go out the night before. So where does it bring me? To step one, and gratitude. And gratitude, you know? There's a sober physician in Marin County by the name of Dr. Gill. Now, I'm sure there are more than one sober physician in Marin County, but he's the one I see most. Gill's a tough old guy who got sober in 1960. French-Canadian tough, you know? And Gill talks a lot about alcoholism, and on one occasion, he was talking to a group of people about the progression of the disease. And he says, stage one alcoholism is called the fun phase. This is when it's really fun. Well, non-alcoholics don't see it that way at all. They don't know how much fun some of us have drinking and using. We had a great time. Great time. I remember saying that at a meeting once, and that I had, for some time, I really had a lot of fun drinking. And this very nervous person came up to me and said, oh, you should never say that at an AA meeting. You'll trigger the newcomer. And I said, oh, right, it's really important to lie to the newcomer, you know? Tell them what you think they should hear. That'll keep them coming back. I think it's real important to tell the truth at meetings and so people can come back. And for a while, I had a great time. I was an awkward kid. I was very, very bright. I knew irregular German verbs. I could not throw a baseball to save my life. This is an awkward place for a 13-year-old kid, a 12-year-old kid. One of the things that worked for me, and I was very socially inept, and I was a bit on the sissy side of things. I had no athletic interest or ability. So what I did by the time I was in high school, 14, 15, 16 years old, I found I could do something that proved my masculinity and manhood. I could drink guys three times my size under the table. It was delicious. My voice changed late. I looked real young. No facial hair. That's why I do it now, you know. I looked like a little kid. And there were guys who had started shaving in the third grade, you know. And they kind of walked into the room with their knuckles scraping on the ground. And they'd have two beers and pass out. I could take a six-pack of beer and a pint of vodka and still move. And I figured that this proved that my testosterone level was just fine. I found my maturity and my masculinity and my self-confidence in the bottle. And it really worked. And it worked even until my adult years. I remember once I was teaching school in Los Angeles, where they had the riots. That's where I taught school. And I used to climb up onto the roof of the building I taught in and smoke dope looking out over Watts. I thought that was very spiritual. Oh, well. Have deep conversations about life. There was a point to that. Hope it comes back real soon. Drinking in L.A., boy, it's what a mess, I'll tell you. I used to get very worried about things. They'll think I've lost my mind. Well, yes, we know that. Drinking fun. Gil said, all right, stage one is the fun stage. Stage two is called fun plus problems. It's still fun, but we start to have problems. I had problems pretty early. Blackouts at an early age. It's hard to remember your first blackout. And if you were a solitary drinker, you'll never be sure. This is why we need families, you know, and video cameras, so we can remember things. The first blackout I can remember is 7th or 8th grade. I was very experimental. I also avoided an awful lot of my peers. They scared me. But I was bright and charming, so I got away with a lot of stuff. I wouldn't stay in school for lunch. I'd come home, fix myself something to eat, watch a little TV, and bicycle back to school. We lived about a mile or 2 miles from school. And I would play with booze. I remember on one occasion trying a tequila milkshake. Grown-ups don't drink tequila milkshakes, trust me. It's why the liquor industry, and this is an opinion, but I am right, always has to sweeten it up. Like Annie Boone Springs Farm is not for grown-ups, it's for kids. When you put booze in chocolate, it's not for grown-ups, it's for kids. How can we get them started young? Let's make it sweet. What a good idea. So I, vanilla ice cream blender tequila. And of course you would not add chocolate to something like that. That was different. And I remember taking a hit out of it and saying, this tastes awful. And then I drank the whole thing. Not a good sign. Not a good sign. So blackouts, I guess they started pretty early. I had them in high school. I sure had them in my 20s. I drove home lots of times, not remembering where or how. The scariest thing in my fourth and fifth step is the drunken driving, which I did for thousands of miles for many years. 5 nights a week for 52 weeks out of the year. For years, I was one of those drunk drivers, and I was never stopped, I never got a ticket. No. I'm always nervous around the bar closing times when I'm out driving. I don't like it. So, what else about problems? This is, by the way, when some of us start getting into trouble with relationships and families and jobs. School become a real problem. The book has an interesting line in it. More than one interesting line, but this was a thing I noticed. In Bill's story, he says, he's a very bright young man. He says on page 2, I took a night law course and obtained employment as investigator for a surety company. I have to wear glasses, I'm 50. The drive for success was on. I'd proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, some became very rich, why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. This is a very energetic, creative fellow. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Now, on page 164, it says, we realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you. Since the book was written in 1939, we have learned some real important things that aren't really talked about in the book. And one of them is that Bill at the law course was not a potential alcoholic. He was an alcoholic. If you are too drunk to read or write at the final, you have crossed the invisible line. But what they didn't know, they didn't know in 1939 that a young person could be an alcoholic. They thought you had to at least be in your 30s. It never occurred to them that you could be 12 years old and have the full-blown symptoms of alcoholism. That's one of the things we've learned. You know? So Bill is not a potential, he's real. And I was real pretty early on. Moods changes, that happened a lot. We call that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. By the way, if you're looking for something to read that is not conference approved, may I suggest Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. It's a terrifying book. I thought it was for junior high school kids, and so with contempt I refused to read it even when I was in junior high school. It's for kids. I read it when I was 15 years sober. It raises the hair on the back of your neck. It's a terrifying book. If you don't want to read the book, just read the last chapter. Dr. Jekyll's the good guy, Mr. Hyde's the bad guy. Dr. Jekyll spends too long in the lab, plays with chemicals, takes them, becomes a monster, and there is no recovery in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Mr. Hyde wins. I not only had a case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I also had a pretty good dose of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. I would drink and I would become dopey, or sleepy, or happy, or grumpy. Occasionally I'd turn into Snow White, which really surprised everybody. It was quite a shock. I was sober a little bit, you know, a couple of months, just coming out of the fog. I was 29 years old when I got sober. I thought I was the youngest alcoholic in the history of the world that had to get sober. Didn't know anything about the program, didn't know anything about alcoholism, knew nothing about me, you know, just nothing. I went to meetings a lot, and I went to meetings because they took the edge off. I was a very edgy guy. I'd go to a meeting, they take the edge off. The edge would grow back. I'd go to a meeting, it would take the edge off. That's still true, by the way. So I'm at a meeting at the El Cerrito Fellowship. No one needs to know where the El Cerrito Fellowship is. No one needs to know where El Cerrito is unless you want to find the El Cerrito Fellowship. Alameda, Oakland, Emeryville, Oakland, Berkeley, Albany, El Cerrito. That's how it goes. There's a BART line there if you're looking for a meeting. Meetings all day long at the El Cerrito Fellowship. And I went there a lot. Weekends were jumpy for me. I didn't have anything to do. And when I had nothing to do, I ended up drunk. This was my pattern. And weekends, what do you do Friday night? What do you do Saturday night? Well, we could stay home. Oh, what a good idea. I just go to a meeting. And at the El Cerrito Fellowship on Friday and Saturday nights, they had a meeting at 6 p.m. They had a meeting at 8 p.m. They had a meeting at 10 p.m. And if you were still a little jumpy, there was a meeting at midnight. There were times I was there for every one of those meetings. Just staying there. How are you? Fine, fine. Glad to be here. Grateful. Grateful. So I asked this old timer with about a year or two, you know. Actually, much longer period of sobriety, actually. I guess he had 20 or 30 years. And I said, how do you know you're an alcoholic? Because maybe I'm just crazy. Maybe I'm just unlucky. I've always thought I was very unlucky. I never get my own way. I am unlucky. My sponsor, who is a desperate alcoholic of the worst type, and who needs meetings as much as anybody I've ever met in the program, is of the opinion that it is a good thing that I do not get my own way. He thinks that the neighborhood is safer if I don't get my own way. Oh, well. I said, how do you know you're an alcoholic? Now, the way he answered was as important as what he said. Because, see, what he could have done is he could have said, I'll tell you how you know you're an alcoholic, you some bitch. He could have said that. I would not have stayed around long. I don't handle that tone of voice well. I don't like being preached to. I don't like being talked down to. I don't like being patronized. I don't like having to swear oaths or get in line. I hate all that stuff. So instead of doing that, he did something that I think was brilliant. Same thing Bill Wilson did and Dr. Bob did and the early AAs did. Instead of telling me what I should be doing, he shared his experience with me. He didn't say, Tom, here's how you'll know you're an alcoholic. He said, here's how I know I'm an alcoholic. He shared his experience. I said, how do you know? He said, well, I have no way of guaranteeing my behavior after my first drink. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, there are times I could drink a lot and nothing would happen. There are other times I would drink just a little, and anything could happen. And that's the story of my drinking. I never knew what would happen. It could be a real easy evening, meaning I got back to my own room in my own bed, woke up the next morning, no vomit, no pee. Success. Other evenings weren't that neat. And I never knew. I never knew. So, stage one alcoholism, fun. Stage two alcoholism, fun plus problems. Stage three alcoholism, problems. The book talks about it a little differently in chapter 11. And when I first got sober, we read this beginning of chapter 11 a lot. It says, for most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. I'm very glad we have this in our literature. We are not prohibitionists. We don't want to outlaw alcohol. If you're able to drink and go to work and not pee on yourself, we're thrilled. We don't know how you do it, but we're real glad for you. And for most people, a contact with alcohol is a pleasant experience. Then Bill writes, But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society. I had friends who would witness the changes in personality in me. They get very nervous and preachy the next day. And I had to make a decision. Do I hang out with my friends or do I drink? I drank. I tolerated my friends, but I drank. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, this is very badly written, by the way. It's so awful, this prose. If a high school sophomore turned this into me, I would have it circled in red and pink and blue and hand back to him with rewrite all over it. This is an awful paragraph. As we become subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens, citizen, inhabitant, participant, denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. I thought I was the only person in the world that ever did that. And I remember, I'm sober a couple of months, coming out of the fog, I hear this read. And I suddenly realized that there was something that Bill Wilson and I had in common. Even back in New York and Akron, Ohio in 1935, there was someone who had that same awful experience that I was having more and more frequently. Just ending up in some awful place, wondering how to ever get out and how to get home and what do you say? Momentarily we did. And the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. I did not know if I was an alcoholic, but I knew I was an unhappy drinker. And I went back, I had a copy of the book. I mean, they make you buy it, you know. I had a copy of the book, and I went home and I reread that page that night. I reread it, and I reread it, and I said, there is something here I can identify with. Then they said, oh, look at the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, the 12 concepts, and the human. I had no idea what they were talking about. I can only do what I can do. And for a long time, my program was real basic and real simple. I went to my first meeting. Happy, joyous people. Well-lit room, big smiley faces. Hi, how long is it? My first day without a drink was the day that Gerald Ford was nominated for President of the United States. That really did happen. That really did happen. It's in the books. You can look it up. I slowly started coming out of this fog, and I went to an AA meeting, and this old guy there said, welcome, and they ran the meeting, and I couldn't figure out what they were talking about, and I guess my first day, I didn't drink Wednesday, I didn't drink Thursday, Friday, I went to this meeting, so 3 days without a drink, and this, young man, younger than me, gave me my program for the next year. He said, we here at Alcoholics Anonymous go to lots of meetings. We don't drink in between meetings. And we don't use no dope. Well, I was shocked by all three. But willing, I mean, this is still true for me. I am willing to follow directions when I'm in pain. When I'm not in pain, I cut corners. But when I'm in pain or when I'm uncomfortable, I follow directions. Whatever a lot of meetings was, I was going to do it. If that meant, I'm glad no one said 90 in 90. Again, others like that kind of structure. I don't handle structure well. I have the tiniest problem with authority. But go to a lot of meetings. We had this guy in the East Bay who said, you know, we do newcomers a great disservice when we tell them to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Because on the 91st day, they come to a meeting and they say, now what should I do? And we say, well, go to 90 more meetings for the next 90 days, ho, 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 you know. And they might feel a little jerked around. It'd be easier if you sat them down and said, listen, amigo, we want you to go to 15,000 meetings in the next 5 years. Any questions? No. So you don't have to wonder about where will I be New Year's Eve, you know, or what am I going to do on my birthday? We have all those meetings to go to. Just go to meetings. Go to meetings. I went to a lot of meetings. Not drinking in between meetings, I'm glad he phrased it that way. I'm glad he didn't try to say, day at a time. Because I had figured day at a time out. That's really trite. Day at a time is very trite. And when I was 13 or 14 or 15, I figured that one out. They say day at a time, but they mean forever. So I can't do day at a time. But we don't drink in between meetings. If I went to more meetings, this would be easier. And I still don't drink in between meetings. I mean, I was at a meeting Thursday night, didn't drink until I went to a meeting on Friday, didn't drink until I went to a meeting today. You know, that's how I do it. As far as the no dope, that just floored me. I had been smoking non-habit-forming marijuana every day for 7 to 10 years. And I thought that marijuana was my little friend. And it was very secret, too, because it was a felony, and if you're a teacher and you get busted on a felony, you don't teach. So it was my little secret buddy, and I didn't tell anyone about it. One of my biggest problems with my drinking and my marijuana usage, of course, was that I was always very depressed. And it never occurred to me that the reason I was depressed was because I was taking large amounts of depressants into my body every day for years. It never occurred to me until I was sober 2 or 3 years. I've never done cocaine, I've never done crack cocaine, I've never dropped acid, which really surprises some people who hear me talk. Because I sound like I stared at the sun for a long time, but this is just alcohol, honest. I went to a shrink once, Dr. Arthur Solomon, Kaiser Hospital, San Francisco, and I tried to get him to give me Valium, and he refused. And I said, why? And he said, because you'd abuse it. And I said, exactly. And we were not communicating. The reason I want to mention that is because I want people to know that there are competent therapists and physicians out there who don't give dope to junkies, you know, and we need to know that, and it's okay to find them and work with them. I've done a little bit of, so the only Valium I've ever taken I've stolen from friends, and I don't think that should count. And I did a little bit of amyl nitrate, but it was just to get to know people, so that was, well. Basically, it's alcohol and pot are my two big favorites. So coming into AA, all of a sudden I'm alcohol and drug free, and now what do we do? And let me talk for 5 more minutes and then we can end and go home in this blizzard. I think step one asks a question. And by the way, you know, for those of you again who aren't familiar with AA, you can disagree with anything I've said. We don't have to agree on anything. You don't have to like me. If you think I'm a jerk, go to another meeting. You know, my sponsor is of the opinion that if you like everybody you've met in AA, it's a good sign you haven't been to enough meetings. You know? Because the traditions don't kick in until we've got some resentments going. You know, then all of a sudden traditions become important. Oof. But step one asks a very simple question, and the question is, are you still having any fun? You know? And if the answer is yeah, well, go get done. You know, this is not a program for people who need it. It's a program for people who want it. And if you are twisted like I am, pain is our best friend. Because pain makes us reach out for help and let go of the stuff that's killing us. And nothing else seems to motivate me. You can't appeal to my higher instincts. I'll just stare at you. But if I'm bleeding and on fire, I'll pay attention. Step two is all about hope. Step one says there's no hope. Step one says we're doomed. Step one says we're powerless. Life is unmanageable. Step one says the fun is way over. Step one says, General Custer, more are coming. Step one says, Noah, it's still raining. For those of us who love alcoholics, I started going to Al-Anon when I was 3 years sober because I had to. I did not want to be a sober person who was shooting people. And that got me to Al-Anon, and I still go to Al-Anon, and I use it a lot in dealing with people I sponsor and dealing with other people I love, because I keep on wanting to run their lives and give advice and rescue galore. I love it. It really makes me high to fix people who are grateful to me for fixing them. And I have to learn how to be helpful and then let go, and how to be helpful and let go, and how to be helpful and let go, and I sometimes can do it and sometimes I can't. Step one. Hold on now, that was going to come back. See, it just went right out of my brain. Step two is all about hope. Step one again. If for those of us who love alcoholics, when they are in crises, be grateful. I'm in such a big mess. Good for you. Glad to hear it. Call your sponsor. That's what you say. So, how do you get from step one, which is all about, boy, are we in trouble, to step two, which says there's a way out? I've been to a meeting more than once where, you know, the topic is step two, and step two says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And I have been to meetings where people get very theological on the nature of God and the nature of meaning and the purpose of purpose and what's it all really mean cosmically and my metaphysics. I really want to drink when people talk like that. I get thirsty. I need bourbon now when people talk like that to me. Step two is about hope. Step two says there's a way out. Maybe not much of a way out, a little bit, but it's there. Came to believe, slowly. How do many of us believe? Badly. Patchwork quilt, little bits, here and there. Faith sometimes wakes up real slowly, and what I came to believe is how there's a way out. Well, don't I have to figure it out first? No. What I want to do, and this is my alcoholism, first I really want to understand the 12 steps. And then I'll take them. No. You take them and then you look back and say, oh. The way they're written is very important. It says, and it's important for me just to look at some of the wording again, and you can tell I taught school forever, I guess. It says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Why suggested? Because then most of us will listen. If it's ordered, demanded, or forced, most of us would die rather than get well. Because we're wired badly. But if it's suggested, if we're invited in, some of us will come along for the ride. And here's what they did. We did this, we did that, we did this, we did that. How do you get from a place of no hope to a place of hope? This was my great question when I turned 20 years sober. And I had to look at my own experience and listen to a lot of other people. I even talked to my sponsor, which I think is going to any length. And sometimes what I hear around the fellowship, and this is, I'm going to express an opinion and a point of view, and you can sure disagree. Some people say, well, you work the program. You get from step one to step two by marching. You know, march, charge, run, stamp your feet, take no prisoners, go. It works when you work it, you know, that kind of thing. Where I get the image of AA being the big spiritual goals gym, you know, we're all just being buffed out spiritually and fine, how are you? Fine, I'm working my program hard. Well, that's not my experience. My experience is I didn't go from step one to two, from no hope to hope, by marching or walking or running or crawling. I got from step one to step two because I got carried there. I got carried there by a power greater than myself, and I had contact with that power working through folks like you. I did all kinds of footwork. Do footwork. Okay. Go to meetings. That's footwork. Say hello to newcomers. Hi. How are you? I have 9 days. No. Oh, you have 6 days. Oh, that's really good. You know, you could do that. Return phone calls, make coffee, sweep. I was at a meeting in L.A., big fancy meeting, dark glasses, L.A. people. They clap for everything. And hundreds of people in the room. And I was nuts. I was very jagged and jumpy and not connecting to anybody in Southern California. And at the end of this great big meeting, every Sunday night, I noticed a group of women and men who were picking up chairs and sweeping the floors. And, you know, A, we don't pick up after ourselves. We spill things and blame others. And I didn't know what to do, but I knew I had to talk to somebody, and I was trying to look very cool, and I talked to the guy standing next to me, and I said, who are these people cleaning up? You know, they hired? And the guy said, oh, those are the ones that stay sober. I picked up a broom. You know, that was the only thing that motivated me. And doing, that's all footwork. And when doing the footwork and hanging out with you, the presence of the higher power, the grace of the higher power, the energy of the higher power, however you think about that, moved me from a place of no hope to hope. For a long time, I believed in hope for you. I knew you'd get well. I didn't think I would. There's a old Jewish writer, 1920s, Czechoslovakian, Hungarian, named Franz Kafka. His vision's a little bleak. I really liked it when I was drinking. And he has a line in one of his books where he says, there is infinite hope, but not for us. Oh, I said, that's it. You know, finally someone understands. You simple-minded, good-hearted people will make it just fine, but me, no. I am too perverted, too twisted, too sarcastic, too heavy. I've had too many chances. I've blown it too often. I'm not going to get it. By hanging out with you, I got carried from a place of no hope to hope. And then you gave me some things to do, like write and, you know, inventory and make amends and buy your sponsor expensive gifts. All those things you're supposed to do. And little by little, I got returned to life. Today, life is really interesting. I like it most of the time. I'm real glad. I don't feel good all the time. I'm not always glad to be here, but I have tools to use. And I have companions who remind me to use the tools. And I'm real glad. In my 40s, What I discovered is that life is full of texture and flavor and color. There's all kinds of things if I want and am able to participate in life. And sober, I really want to do that. There's a lady from New York, and this is my last point. There's a lady from New York who I heard talk once, and sometimes in AA we think we have to be so happy all the time or the newcomer will be discouraged, you know, then we wonder why they don't come back. Hi, glad to see you. Leave me alone, you know. You know, when you're having a bad day, please say you're having a bad day and sober. People want to hear that, so we know we can stay sober having bad days. But anyway, this lady was talking, and someone said, keep coming back, it gets better, it gets better, it gets better. Every day is better, every day is golden. Well, that is not my experience. One of the women in the East Bay says, when you get sober, you feel better, you feel everything better. Which means the highs, the lows, the ups, the downs. I mean, there's a richness there. And I frequently feel I would rather feel something than nothing. That's a brand new thought for me. But I choose that. So she said, keep coming back and get the better. She said, we do not say that in New York. And this lady said, well, what do you say in New York? And Bibi said, in New York we say, keep coming back. First it gets better. Then it gets worse. Then it gets real. Then it gets different. Then it gets real different. And that is my experience, strength, and hope. And I'm glad to be here with you sharing it tonight. Go home.